This is the World Cafe. Elton John is one of the most visible, successful, and prolific songwriters of our time. He has sold over 250 million albums, a remarkable performer. He has dazzled us live for the last three decades. And when you look at the string of albums he produced in the 70s, you realize how deeply embedded the songs that he and Bernie Taupin wrote are in our psyche. Beginning with your song on the first album in 1970.
It's a little bit funny, this feeling inside. I'm not one of those who can easily hide. I don't have much money, but boy, if I did, I'd buy a big house where we both could live. If I was a sculptor, but then again, no, or a man who makes potions in a traveling show. I know it's not much, but it's the best I can do. My gift is my song, and this one's for you. You can tell everybody this is your song. It may be quite simple, but now that it's done, I hope you don't mind. I hope you don't mind that I put down in words how wonderful life is while you're in.
Elton John's new album, The Captain and the Kid, picks up the story of Elton and his lyricist Bernie Taupin that began on his massive hit album Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy in 1975. I asked Elton about how the idea of doing an autobiographical record with the original Captain Fantastic album came about.
I don't know what the original idea was for Captain Fantastic. It must have come from Bernie. But it was so long ago now, it's 31 years ago. I actually don't really remember the actual reason why we did it. I just know that when we did do it, it was written out and recorded in running order, which helped a lot because, you know, one of the hardest things to do is to do an album and then put all the tracks in a sort of, some sort of semblance in which they fit together. This album was the result of my ex-manager, Merck Mercuriadis, saying, you know, you're always talking about how you became these two people, how Elton became Captain Fantastic and Bernie became the Brown Dirt Cowboy and lived their dreams. Why didn't you write the follow-up album? Because the first album basically goes from 1967, when Bernie and I first met, to 1970, before we came across to America for the Troubadour Club. And so it was an album that was really dealing with the start of a great friendship and relationship, but with a lot of disappointment and rejection. And this current album goes right up into the present day and deals with having to deal with success, excess, stress, and getting a balance in your life, and all the things that go with becoming incredibly successful very quickly.
Were you at all prepared for what happened when success finally came to you? It's funny, there's a song about New York City in here, but Los Angeles really was where it all started.
Yeah. Los Angeles was, you know, the first place we played in America. It was the Troubadour Club, September 1970. Actually, I didn't really want to come at that particular time. I've always wanted to come to America, but I thought we were getting as a band, we were learning our craft in England and getting a good reputation. And even though the Elton John album was being released in America, I thought maybe it wasn't particularly the right time. How wrong can you be? And so everything that happened to us at the Troubadour Club was a complete surprise, and a surprise to the audience, because with the Elton John album, they thought, because of the album graphics and the artwork that it was, and the content of the music, that it was going to be a very serious performer that met them on stage. And of course, I was not a serious performer. I was, but I mean, I came out in hot pants and flying boots, and I had a three-piece band, and we completely rocked the house down. And we did, you know, much more rock and roll versions of the songs, like 60 Years On, The King Must Die, stuff like that. And so I think it was a surprise for both artist and audience. I wasn't remotely prepared for what was going to happen so quickly. I mean, you know, I wouldn't say it was a fluke, but we were certainly in the right place at the right time. I mean, Robert Hilburn gave us the review in the Los Angeles Times, which spread across the country. And then we went to San Francisco and played the Troubadour there, and then the Playboy Club in New York City. But from then on, it was just, you know, gung-ho. Your song came out, it was a hit. And we never really looked back. It was a case of being in the right place at the right time and then just making sure that you just enjoyed it. And the next 5 years of our life was just completely adrenaline, instinct, and the best 5 years you could possibly have.
So let's begin with the way the album begins back in 1970. This is Postcards from Richard Nixon. This is a live version from Elton John and the band.
To play. Joseph Nixon said, I gotta go, but you can't stay.
Postcards from Richard Nixon. That's where we pick up the story with the captain and the kid, and the story that we left off with back in 1975 with Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy. And I'm talking with Elton John. Elton, people may not know that for when you first met Bernie Taupin, for the first 6 months, you two wrote together having never met.
That's correct. It was, you know, an odd arrangement, to say the least. And it's kind of carried on that way. We never write together in the same room. But, no, he lived in Lincolnshire, and, you know, he sent the lyrics down by post or to Ray Williams at Liberty Records, and it gave them to me. And I was just experimenting, and I really enjoyed the fact that I was writing to lyrics. I knew that I wasn't a good lyric writer. People even now say, you know, why don't you write your own lyrics? You're very verbose. You're, you know, you speak very well. But, you know, there's an art to writing lyrics. I write melodies. I'm not a great lyric writer, and I've given that over to Mr. Taupin, and it was strange. Yeah.
What did you find out about him from his lyrics before you met him? Did you think you knew him?
Oh, I just thought he was incredibly romantic, incredibly mature. I mean, when you consider that your song, it's always continued to amaze, never continued to amaze that your song, which is the most, I think, beautiful lyric, although he thinks it's very naive, was written by a 19-year-old, a teenager.
Wow.
It's astonishing. And his, you know, things like Tumble on Tumbleweed and Elton John, some of the lyrics were kind of influenced by our contemporaries at the time. But he was so far ahead of his game as far as he had an incredible knowledge and love of Americana. And that shaped not only our songs, but it definitely shaped the music in our songs.
Did you worry at all about his reaction to your melodies at first?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I had no idea what he expected. I mean, but, you know, we clicked immediately we met. We were two lost souls, and we bonded immediately. We became like two brothers, even though he had two brothers of his own. He became the brother in my life that I never had. He became my best friend, and we shared everything. We went to the cinema together. We went to shows together. We were inseparable. He taught me about certain types of music. I taught him about others. It was an incredible kind of... All the time that we spent together, we really, really enjoyed. Apart from the fact that, as I say, in the early days, we were getting knocked back some of the time. We had to write some lyrics and songs for other people, which we weren't very good at. We've never been very good at that.
Elton John is our guest today, and we're talking about the Captain and the Kid, the new album that that continues tracing the relationship between Elton and Bernie Taupin over the years. Now, for this new album, what kind of conversations did you have before Bernie went off and wrote? Because he's picked certain highlights along the way, and did you all agree on what those were?
I never ask him what he's going to write. It's always been the surprise factor. I never say, listen, you should write something like this. I would never dare. He's always, you know, gone away and surprised me. And that element of surprise is something that keeps our relationship fresh and exciting. I mean, I still haven't lost the pleasure of writing a melody to one of his lyrics and seeing his face when he really loves what I've done. That hasn't changed from your song up to the present day. So I just, you know, I thought, good luck. You know, you're going to have to... I didn't want it to be a double album, and nor did he. He just picked little, very important parts of our life. The second track on the album is called Just Like Noah's Ark, and it tells about when we first came to America, very successful. We were followed around by every manager, everybody wanting a piece of the pie. And because we were inseparable, we were kind of like a human shield to these people. Because even then, even though we were inexperienced and somewhat naive, we could see that these people weren't exactly the best people on the planet. But he pinpointed so many things, the drugs, the fact that... you know, we were getting on each other's nerves because he traveled with us as a member of the band, really. And he wasn't a member of the band, but, you know, we went everywhere together. And Tinderbox is a song that really explains on how, you know, we could do no wrong. And then all of a sudden a wind of change blew across our sails and we were in each other's pockets and, you know, we needed a break from each other. And there's a great misconception that when we did stop writing with each other for a while that we'd broken up. We actually never did break up. We never put a statement out as that fact. But because we, you know, our names appeared on different records with other writers, people assumed that, and naturally, that we, you know, we'd fallen out with each other. That was not the case. We just gave each other the artistic freedom to write with other people, and that saved our relationship. Because I think if we'd have said to each other, you can't write with someone else, that would have been the end. And although it was a difficult period because I think we were both a teeny bit jealous of each other, we had to, which is natural because we were so close to each other, we had to let each other go in order for us to come back together again. We'd been through so much. We'd been so, you know, we produced so much product in 5 years. It was only natural that that was going to happen. And I think we both knew it would happen.
Well, this is Tinderbox. This is Tinderbox from the new The Captain and the Kid from Elton John.
Nostradamus said, I predict that the world will end at 6:30. What he didn't say was exactly when. Was he listening to the radio? Was he listening to the government? Well, it got us spooked anyway. We've been running hot up until today. But a wind of change blew across our sails. We were coasting on a winning streak. We were kings until the power failed. Been living in a tinder box, and two sparks can set the whole thing off. Rubbing up together around the clock. Lately we've been getting more rolling rock. You and me together in a tinder box. Tinder box, and two sparks can set the whole thing off. Rubbing up together around the clock.
Now that song, Tinderbox, is followed up by And the House Fell Down, and which is a song about, in your eyes, things kind of collapsing. Yeah, collapsing from having 5 number one albums in a row.
Yeah. Yeah, more of a personal collapse, this song. It's, it's about, you know, the drug taking, the paranoia that goes along with drug taking. Bernie, I think, thought I was going to write a ballad. Now, there's no way that you could have write a ballad. It's got to be very tongue-in-cheek because the lyrics are pretty straight on. It's a bit like we wrote a song, I think, on Honky Chateau called Think I'm Going to Kill Myself, which was a tongue-in-cheek suicide, teenage suicide song. And so this is the way I approach this one as well. But it's it tells a story. I'd be staying up for 3 days, 3 nights. Every little sound, I get paranoid. The leaf blower, I couldn't sleep with the curtains open. I didn't know what time of day it was. And both of us had that kind of thing going on in our lives, which, thank God, we came through. But it, you know, it went on a little too long.
And this is And the House Fell Down. Subjects that song addresses were not totally unusual for the certainly the time, and not unusual at all for what you do for a living. Why do you think that performers are so susceptible?
I think it's these ridiculous hours we keep. We don't lead a normal life as far as going to bed, the traveling, the eating. Everything is completely alien to what everyone else does. From my point of view, I'd never seen a drug or touched a drug until a long time into my career. I didn't even know my band were doing it. I mean, I was very naive. And I just thought, you know, I don't smoke, so maybe I'll try the cocaine. And that was the worst thing I could have ever done because I had an instant liking for it. And I'm an excessive person. I can't have one of anything. So initially, it made me very happy, and it made me kind of filled me with confidence because I was very shy. But it's the sort of drug that's very insidious. And you know, I'd give up for a long time, and then I'd come back, and the more that you stayed away from it, the more you wanted it. And when you came back and did it again, it got worse and worse. And eventually, I always said the drug that opened me up, because it made me verbose, closed me down, because I ended up by living, you know, sitting in my bedroom for 2 weeks on my own. I cannot really recommend that drug at all. It's a horrible drug. And as I say, I didn't know how to get out of the situation once I was in it. It's fairly easy. You just say, can I, somebody help me, please? But I didn't have that humility in me to do that.
It's interesting. Way before that, back in the 70s, I had a chance to be, I was in a room with you. You were being interviewed. And I was struck by your confidence at that point. You were very, very assured of yourself. And I believe it was after the second album had come out. And I was really impressed by that and by your intelligence in the situation. I've been around a lot of people, and they didn't always have that confidence. A lot of people doing what you're doing.
Well, I was musically confident,
yeah.
Incredibly confident about my music and the way I handled myself on stage. Except, you know, there are two personas. There's one on stage and one, you know, the Elton John persona. And then off stage, finding the balance between having that all that success on stage and, you know, everything to do with the career. And then you leave your personal thing behind. And there was no balance in my life. And as confident I was, and I was confident of everything I did, because I had adrenaline going for me. And I was young. And, when you're young, you have no fear. And I wasn't thinking about a personal life. I wasn't thinking about anything at all except my career. And in the end, that catches up with you. And that led to me taking the drugs. And then, of course, the drugs completely lead you to a false illusion and a ridiculous mindset. Anything that was out of whack before gets completely heightened by the use of drugs. And that was the worst thing I could have ever done.
Coincidence that you got sober and fell in love?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I didn't really grow up until I got sober. How can you? I mean, you can't take drugs and you can't drink and have that kind of lifestyle where you're so up one minute, down the next. You're not a stable person. Thank God I kept working when I was, as a musician, I toured and I made records. I didn't sit there just taking drugs. I wanted to work because I love music so much. But, you know, you can't, honestly, and no one can say to me that you can be a sensible, humble, and decent person if you're taking as many drugs and drinking as much as I did from time to time. There's no way you can do that. And when I got sober in 1990, it was, to me, the best thing I'd ever done in my life because I certainly learned how to live again. I had to deal with my phobias and my shyness and find out what made me drink and take drugs in the first place. A lot of things that I needed to check out, I had to do it, and I had to work really hard at it. And I enjoyed every single minute of it because it meant that I woke up every morning in a happy place. And, you know, it's been going on now for 16 years, I just wish I'd have done it sooner. But, you know, you can't regret that. At least I did it. But I wasted a lot of my life by doing that. I wouldn't recommend it. Young people are going to do it anyway, young musicians, because they think it's the thing to do. But if you have the kind of personality, then it's addictive personality, then it's a really dangerous position to put yourself in.
Elton John. More about the songs on his new album, The Captain and the Kid, plus a huge music fan, Elton talks about how he's helped younger bands he's liked. And we get a bit of a bombshell about his record company and management situation when we return to the World Cafe. I'm David Dye. Elton John is my guest today. More of our discussion about his new album, The Captain and the Kid, which continues the story of Elton and lyricist Bernie Taupin, which began with his 1975 album, Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy.
Song on here that is called Blues Never Fade Away, which it's kind of a survivor's guilt song in a way. It's talking about a lot of people who are gone.
Yeah, it's I put myself at risk, at sexual risk, you know, in the days when AIDS came in. I had my pre-AIDS thing in the 70s with Studio 54 and everything was great, and suddenly this dark, horrible disease descended upon us. And yes, I survived that. And it's also about people who are taken from us too soon. The first verse deals with a friend of ours, Bernie Knight, who had a restaurant in Los Angeles, who died of AIDS. The second's a friend of Bernie's who had an aneurysm and 21 and died on the floor of a Hollywood arcade. And the third one is Johnny Versace, who was shot outside his home. And it's a question of saying, why are these people taken from us so soon? I mean, I've had two of my close friends shot outside their doorstep in America. I have had countless people taken from me early because of AIDS, but of other things. Everybody, I sing that song and I say to the audience, there's not one person here that cannot have had this happen to them. And you ask yourself, why them? Why them? And this is kind of, yeah, it's a guilt survivor song. And it's like asking the question. It's like we're playing this Russian roulette game, and some of us get to survive it and some of us don't.
And there are so many other people. You alluded to John Lennon, but then there's Ryan White. There's so many other people in your
Princess
life.
Princess Diana. I mean, yeah. It's just, you know, it's you know, you see someone like Ryan White. Ryan White was a huge catalyst in, as people know, in getting me sober. I mean, it was 6 months after he died that I finally got myself together, because that whole experience of being with him for the last week of his life, along with his family in Indianapolis, was quite an eye-opener for me, and quite a sad indictment of how my life was. So, yeah. So that's Blues Never Fade Away.
He wasn't famous, but I sure did love him. I got his picture in a little frame. He lost his life to a big disease before it even had a name. But there's so many more, and I've lost count. The hows and whys aren't important now. All that matters is they came around and brightened up our lives. She was 21 with her life ahead. You don't need to know her name. She breathed her last on the cold stone floor of a Hollywood arcade. But fate's right hand isn't always just. Puts a lot of pressure on your faith and trust. She was just a little girl and had enough to rage against the day. And how did we get so lucky? Targets on the rifle range. Who makes the call and who gets to choose? Who gets to win and who gets to lose? It's like we're rolling dice in the belly of the blues. And blues never fade.
Elton John and Bernie Taupin's work on The Captain and the Kid, and that's Blues Never Fade Away, and we're getting a chance to talk with Elton about many aspects of his life. Your success has been over decades. It's highly unusual.
It's because I think I'm still basically a fan at heart. I love trying new things. I'm not afraid to try new things. People still have a go at me in concert saying, thank God he's doing this instead of sickly stuff for The Lion King. Well, The Lion King was a different project. It wasn't anything to do with an Elton John album or anything. It was written for a purpose, and for the purpose it was written for, it was extremely successful. But you have to, you know, people want you to stay in one pocket all the time, and if you venture outside of that pocket sometimes, you get knocked. But you've got to try, otherwise you're not going to improve musically, and then you're not going to have the chance to work with many more important and talented people. I still go and buy my records every Tuesday. I still love to go into a CD store, although I say one day it's going to be obsolete. I mean, Tower Records in Sunset Boulevard, I've been buying my records there for 37 years, and it's closing. And it's like, I think I've spent more money in that store. I guarantee you I've spent more money in that store than any other person. And it, to me, it's the saddest day. I went in there last week when I was in Los Angeles, and it was a really sad day. I mean, they say that one day there won't be any CDs, and people will just download music onto their phone. It would be a criminal day if that ever happened. I mean, I like to have the object. It's like going, you know, if for me, buying a CD is like going to an artist exhibition. You go and look at every picture on the wall and see what you think of the exhibition. You don't just say, oh, I've seen one picture and it's a great exhibition, because the night, say 11, maybe awful photographs or awful paintings. So for me, it's about listening to the whole thing as a whole. And that's what, you know, satellite radio gives us the chance to do and maintain that kind of, you know, that quality control where you can actually go and listen to stuff that you normally wouldn't hear. We live in a soundbite mentality. We live in a ringtone mentality and environment, and I can't stand it. I'm older, and I hate it. I like to investigate an artist's talent from start to finish. So that's kept me fresh, liking younger bands, mixing with younger bands.
Well, let's talk about the talents that you end up giving thanks to on the album, because since this, almost every one of these people has had a new record.
Yeah.
And Scissor Sisters, of course, you're involved with Ta-Da.
I helped write the first single, I Don't Feel Like Dancing, which is an enormous record in Britain. They can't seem to crack it over here. I don't think the record company really knows what to do with them, but they're enormous. Act all overseas. They broke in Britain first, as did Rufus Wainwright, who I also thank. It seems that we have a much better, you know, there's more of a chance for a Ray LaMontagne or a Rufus Wainwright to have success in Britain, because Radio 1 plays newer artists. It doesn't play the same records time and time again, like most formulated radio programs do on the normal radio networks. I find that really depressing. I find everything's so categorized and lumped in together. Instead of being able to hear great music of a different kind next to each other, it's all of the same sort of music. And that wasn't the case when I first came to America with the advent of FM radio. It was like incredibly exciting.
So that leads me to the question about, you've been talking about working with Pharrell doing a hip-hop record.
I don't know if that's going to happen now, because I've left my record label by mutual consent, I think. I don't really want to go into that in the moment, because, you know, it's a bit of a sore subject with me. But we know what we're going to do as far as the next record goes, but we won't be recording it for quite a while until the situation gets sorted out of which record label I'm on, which record company I'm with. It's a bit of a mess at the moment. I was very disappointed in the way the record came out. There was never a store poster. There was never any promotion in the stores. And I think basically the record company, thinking I was going to do a hip-hop record, which has tremendous commercial possibilities, just thought they might just put this one out and say, well, we'll just put this one out. And I think that's the case. And I met with the record company. I had lunch with them at my house in France, all the heads of the record company, and I didn't get that impression. I mean, I'm not under no illusion that I'm not going to put a record out and sell millions and millions of copies, because those days have gone. But, you know, I just wanted a little effort and to go into a record shop. And we've been all over Canada, and we've been all over America, and not one store that we've been in has had a poster. I think they didn't spend a penny on in-store. And you can't do that. You have to let people know that the record's out. People, we've had incredible reviews for this album, but people don't read reviews. I mean, people in the music business do, but, you know, people have got, you know, they have busy lives. They haven't got time to scan things. They might go into a CD store to buy a Justin Timberlake record or something. Or if they see a poster by someone else, they'll think, oh, that's out, I might buy that. It's like when you go to the cinema, you can't get in to see the film you've been to see, so you go and see another movie. It's been incredibly disappointing, and I feel slightly betrayed, but I'm not going to cry in my milk about it. It's I produce a really, I think, incredible piece of work that is the best I can do at this particular time in my life. It's an honest piece of work, and all I wanted them to do was to promote it to the best of their abilities, and that hasn't happened, so we've parted companies.
Let's finish up with a live version of The Bridge, which comes at a central point in the album. What's this one about?
Well, The Bridge is basically about our songwriting. Like, you know, you think you've written the perfect song, and you're always in touch or in search of the perfect song. Ironically enough, early on in my career, Your Song was my first hit, and that's as damn near as perfect song as we've ever written. And we've had to follow that up ever since. I mean, many an artist probably would have fallen by the wayside, because that is, you know, lyrically probably a faultless song. So every time that you've written a great song, or you think you've come to a point where you think you're unassailable, something happens. And you have to cross that bridge, and you have to have the... It's like us knowing that our record sales would fall off, and that we would... We knew that was coming. What were we going to do? Sulk? But it also applies to any walk of life. I mean, you all have crises in our lives which are really bad. I mean, forget selling records. That's nothing. People who have illnesses and loss, and we've got so many letters from people saying, you're right, you know, I haven't made that leap of faith yet, but I must do it. I'm stuck in a rut. I've got to make... Your instinct tells you when you should do something, but sometimes it's very difficult. You know, it's all right for me to say, you know, this is about songs. It's easy for me. I'm a very rich man. But wealth doesn't come into it. It's about having the courage to not have a drink anymore, to not, it's, you must, you know, those decisions that you must make, otherwise you're going to get left behind.
The Bridge, live version of the song from the new album, The Captain and the Kid. Our conversation with Elton John took place in Toronto this November. Elton is currently on tour in Australia.